Well, here we are again. Welcome to another NABBW teleseminar on a topic of huge interest to boomer women and their families. Generally, I think everybody cares about money and how to hold on to it. So in a moment, I will introduce our guest expert, Pamela Sams, a certified retirement planning counselor and NABBW's retirement planning expert, to start our discussion titled, Six More IRA Planning Mistakes to Avoid. Yes, we covered six big mistakes in our last call, but there's a lot more to cover, so we decided to do a second call on IRAs. Now, before Pam and I launch into this discussion, I'd like to introduce myself and tell you a little bit about the National Association of Baby Boomer Women. I'm Ann Holmes, your moderator and the Boomer-in-Chief of the National Association of Baby Boomer Women, an organization dedicated to educating and empowering women at midlife. You can find us in a number of places online, including our website, which is at www.nabbw.com, our forum at boomerwomenspeak.com, and our Facebook page, the newest site, which is getting a lot of traction lately. You'll find that at facebook.com/NABBW. Now, if you can't recall all those URLs, don't worry. Just search on the keywords Baby Boomer Women, and you'll find all of our sites at the top of the first page in the search engine, whichever one you use. Now, our NABBW teleseminars are one of the many benefits we provide our members. This live call is free and available to the public, but we also have a collection of over 100 past teleseminar recordings that are available on our website, and access to them is free to our gold-level membership. Now, let's take a minute and discuss the format of tonight's call. Be sure and get comfortable and make sure you have paper and pen, because based on the popularity of our first call on IRA planning mistakes, I know you're going to want to take some notes here tonight. For the next 45 minutes or so, the phone lines will be muted, and Pam and I will be discussing tonight's topic. Then I will open the lines for questions from our listening audience. If you have a question before the lines are open, use the box on your computer screen to type your question into the box. I'll see it and then pass it on to Pam at the appropriate time. Now, moving forward, our guest tonight, Pamela J. Sams, CRPC, hardly needs an introduction, as she is a frequent guest and always covers important information related to money and financial planning, something I find women really don't know enough about. So let me start by telling you a little bit more about Pam. Pamela J. Sams, CRPC, is NABBW's Retirement Planning Associate and an expert in personal finance. She's spent the last dozen years helping women and their families improve their personal and financial wealth through solid financial planning. Pam is president of Jackson Sams Financial Services, a financial planning and wealth management firm located in Herndon, Virginia, near the Dulles Corridor. There, she focuses on helping women understand the importance of financial and retirement planning by placing their needs first. She firmly believes sound investment management starts with goal-oriented planning, which is why she insists that before investment decisions can be made, her clients need to develop their own financial plan. I'm sure that they don't have to do it all on their own. I'm sure she gives them help on that. But everybody needs an individual plan is what I was trying to say. A graduate of the University of Missouri Columbia, Pam holds an MBA in financial management from Averett University. She's earned several client service and financial planning awards and successfully earned her CRPC, Chartered Retirement Planning Counselor certification, through the College of Financial Planning. Now, in the past, Pam and I have talked about how so many couples are retirement challenged because they don't take time to sit down and really talk about their retirement goals and dreams and the financial strategies that make retirement possible. This is a very real concern. In fact, the Employee Benefit Research Institute, which goes by the initials EBRI, just published its annual Retirement Confidence Survey, which confirmed what Pam and I have been, and probably many of you, have been very aware of. Number one, Americans are living longer, and number two, they do not have anywhere near enough saved for retirement. Now, that new survey just further confirms why Pam and I decided a few months ago to hold one teleseminar each month on retirement planning topics. We're delighted that all of you who are listening have joined us for this call, and now I ask you to help me welcome NABBW's own retirement planning expert, Pamela J. Sams.
Hey, hey everybody, how is it going? We've been away for 2 weeks now, so I just wanted to make sure we had an opportunity to kind of recap what happened in the first phone call, because it's about 12 IRA planning mistakes. So I want to make sure we get to cover the first six, and then we'll cover the next six tonight as well. So did you want me to just go ahead and jump in there, Ann, and just kind of recap?
Sure. I know that we've covered stretch IRAs, fiduciary planning, spousal rollovers, the rules for required minimum distribution, and the importance of certain deadlines. But I'd like to, you know, I'd be happy to have you review that a little bit more.
Yeah, well, we had talked about the stretch IRA, the opportunity for people if they're not going to use their IRA dollars and wanted to transfer it or roll it over or to another beneficiary, the opportunity to stretch those dollars across generations. So we talked a little bit about beneficiary choices, taxes, and flexibility as it relates to stretch IRAs. Then we talked about the importance of beneficiary planning, really making sure you update the beneficiaries at least once a year, or at least check on your beneficiaries once a year just to make sure they're not outdated, anything is missing, or they're inconsistent with what your wishes are. So really making sure you do a beneficiary check every year. As it relates to spousal rollovers, looking at taking advantage of some of the deadlines there, if the spouse is older than 70 and a half, or if it's under, and if you have a 10-year gap in there, if your spouse is older by 10 years, there are certain rules that you have to talk about. So we talked about spousal rollover and rules there. And then we talked about a very interesting topic, which I don't think a lot of people are aware of, which was anyway, net unrealized appreciation of company stock. So if you have company stock inside your IRA, making sure you separate that out first so it can get favorable tax treatment, capital gains tax treatment versus ordinary income, which would be normally for IRAs, so really separating that out. So that's probably something new that a lot of people are not aware of. It's called NUA, net unrealized appreciation of company stock. And then really looking at some of the did you want to say something there, Anne?
No, I just want to say, yes, that's something we really need to be aware of.
Yes, definitely. And then IRA planning, missing deadlines, making sure you take advantage of the RMD deadlines, the multiple beneficiary. If you decide to split your beneficiary, there are certain deadlines and rules. If a beneficiary inherited an IRA, you have to make sure you disclaim the IRA, or you have estate taxes that are due after the person who had passed away and you inherited the IRA. There's certain rules that you have to follow there. So really making sure you don't have any missing any deadlines for your IRA there. And then we talked about minimum distributions and the rules and making sure you don't fall into that 50% penalty if you don't take any the appropriate RMD distribution from your IRA. So the importance of maybe asset consolidation, so make sure you have all your IRAs in one spot. And then you know, making sure you do a recalculation for IRAs that if you had taken distributions before you got 70 and a half, to make sure you're still taking enough of a distribution out. And then the differences between what 401ks would do and what IRAs would do as regards to minimum distributions. So that's kind of a recap just to talk about the first six, the stretch IRA, the importance of beneficiary planning, spousal IRA rollovers on your IRA, company stock inside of IRA, missing any important deadlines as it relates to an inherited IRA, and then RMDs would be the first six. But I also wanted to cover, and if I could take a moment, we had a couple of questions from our last phone call that I wanted to clarify on that. And one related to prohibited transactions was a question. And what that was is really there are prohibited transactions or improper uses of transactions inside as to the traditional IRA account, things such as borrowing money from it, selling property in it, using it as a loan, as a security against a loan, and things like that. And so if you have certain transactions that you do inside an IRA, then the IRS could come back and what they call stop the account from being an IRA, and then you have certain tax implications with that. So you don't want to fall prey to some of these transactions, mainly using it as a security against a loan, buying property for personal use inside an IRA, or selling property inside of an IRA. So those are some of those prohibited transactions as well. And then the second question related to how do you calculate RMD calculations, and I think we had talked a little bit about the it's an actuarial calculation, but the formal name is called Uniform Life Expectancy Tables. They're based on what the IRS comes up with in terms of your account balance at the end of the year, divided by this basically life expectancy number that's on the table. So you have three tables that you work from, either a single life, table one, a joint life survivor would be a table two, or uniform life. So depending on your particular situation, you would use one of those tables, and then you can find out, it'll give you a number, let's say, 15 or something, and you take your account balance divided by that particular number that you get off the table, and then that's how they come up with an RMD distribution. So that's just basically a recap on that and also some of the questions just to clarify those.
Excellent. All important topics, but as they say in those infomercials, but wait, there's more.
Yeah, but wait, there's more, exactly.
So tonight we address six more IRA topics where people tend to make mistakes, and I know that we've got a lot to cover in these six because they're kind of global topics and the lots of pieces to each of the global topics. So why don't I start with the first question, which is that you wanted to talk about the IRD deduction.
Correct. The IRD deduction, it stands for income in respect of decedent. It's what it happens when a beneficiary doesn't take advantage of what they call IRD. And what that is that income is payable after the death of a person who is entitled to that income that would have been taxable if he or she had lived to receive it. So what happens is that the person who inherits the IRA now has what we call these IRDs, which is income payable, income in respect to the decedent. So that may include IRA assets, annuity earnings, any retirement plan benefits, any unpaid compensation, and it's often subject to both income as well as estate taxes when you're dealing with that. So what's important for owners and beneficiaries of IRAs need to know is that there is a relief from double taxation from recipients of an IRD. It's available on a form of a federal income tax deduction equal to the estate tax paid on the IRD. So basically, if you think you're going to inherit an IRA and it may have some IRDs, you definitely want to make sure you consult your tax advisor because there are some ways to get past some of the double taxation that may occur with an inherited IRA. So really making sure you're aware of the whole concept of income in respect to decedent if you inherit an IRA.
That one seemed really important to me. I had not heard of it before, so I confess, Pam, that I did a little online research on it before our call so I wouldn't be totally stupid about it. And it seemed to me that one of the things I was reading is that the IRD might be taxed at the rate of the decedent and not at the rate of the person who's now going to receive that money, unless you fill out this form. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so you want to make sure you take advantage of that income tax deduction first of that because you don't want to end up with what we call a double taxation in situation. Mm-hmm. So that's why if you're aware of it being there before you file your taxes, then you can take advantage of it. If not, then you're like, tough luck, I guess, or have to refile it with the IRS. But knowing that may pop up in that particular situation and knowing how to handle it is basically, one of those things, like I said, don't fall into this mistake. If it occurs, you'll know how to handle it now based on, our conversation on that. But it is all, income in respect to the season, get some relief from it, but you do have to consult your tax advisor to make sure what you fill out the proper forms, federal income tax deduction forms.
Okay. All right. Well, there may be questions from our audience more about that later, but since you've given us a good basic understanding of it right now, why don't we move on to another type of IRA? We haven't really discussed a Roth IRA in the past, and I know it's a newer sort of an IRA, but one that has different rules and different applications, I think, than the IRA that's the traditional one. So I think we'd like to have you give us a general review of the Roth IRA, what it is and why we would want to or not want to have one.
Exactly. And I put down here, one of the IRA mistakes is really not taking advantage of the Roth IRA if it's appropriate for you. The way that IRAs work is that it's basically a retirement account in reverse. So it's tax benefits now or the tax benefits later. So it's kind of like, do I want my dessert now or do I want my dessert later?
Mm-hmm.
So with a traditional retirement account or a traditional IRA, you lower your taxable income now. So if you wanted to put in $5,000 or $6,000 that you're allowed to put in, you can actually take a tax deduction off of your tax return if you're not contributing to, let's say, a retirement plan at work, and then basically they kind of phase it out depending on the deductibility of those particular IRAs. But what happens with a Roth won't decrease your taxable income now, but it can be tax-free in retirement. So that's basically, like I said, the tax benefit being, do you want the tax relief now or do you want the tax relief later on that? So the Roth is potentially a very valuable retirement resource. I mean, you know, not only are qualified withdrawals tax-free, but the Roth IRA distributions do not impact the taxability of Social Security. And then qualifying for Roth IRAs passed to beneficiaries is income tax-free, and it also doesn't have that 17.5 rule where you have to start taking money out of it. So it's very valuable retirement resource if you're eligible. So that's the caveat, if you're eligible. So there are income limits that affect the eligibility of Roth IRAs. So make sure you definitely talk with your tax advisor, your financial advisor. But some of the Roth eligibility, let's say, for instance, if you're single or filing single or head of household, you're dealing with an adjusted gross income between $112,000 up to $127,000. If you make over, if your adjusted income is adjusted gross income is over $127,000, if you're a single, then you're not eligible to contribute to the Roth. So that is for you there. Now, if you are married filing jointly, that it caps out at $188,000, and then you're not eligible after that. So $178,000 to $188,000 married filing jointly, you're eligible to contribute to the Roth. So you have to look at, you know, the eligibility rules, but if you do fall in those numbers, like I said, if it's appropriate, taking advantage of a Roth IRA now when we're probably more than likely in a lower tax environment than we would probably be in the future, then it's probably best to try to reposition those dollars into a tax-free situation now versus later.
Mm-hmm.
So right. What you can do for if you are eligible for Roth, they do have the $5,500. You can put in up to $5,500 for 2013, and if you are over 50, you can put in an extra $1,000. So you can actually put up in $6,500 into a Roth for 2013.
Mhm. Okay. Now, I know there's this wasn't something I was planning to ask you, but it just occurred to me. I know that I think we'll lower it down here. I keep hesitating more. I believe that you can still contribute sometimes into an IRA after the December 31st deadline of the prior year, like in this case we're in 2013. But in some cases, you can still contribute for 2012 in order to lower your taxes. When does that factor in with an IRA, with a Roth IRA or not?
Not with a Roth, because you're not taking advantage of a taxable income situation.
Okay.
You're not going to lower your taxable income this year. But if you're eligible, if you want to still put in a contribution for 2012 for traditional, you do have up into the tax deadline, which would be April 15th, in order to do that. So then that would, in essence, have the capability of lowering your taxable income. And like I said, it depends on, you know, if you're contributing to a 401k or 457 or some other type of plan, a portion of that may be tax deductible, maybe not the whole thing. So you do have to check with your tax advisor and see what's deductible. But you do have those rules that you are eligible to put in a traditional up to the amount to lower your taxable income. This really depends on how much can be taken off your actual tax return.
Excellent. All right. Are there any other things that we should be talking about with regard to IRA contribution limits? You mentioned some talking about the Roth, but are there other contribution limit information that we should be aware of in order to
We definitely talked about what you can put in, and that's, you know, the second one of the other mistakes is really not taking advantage of increased contribution limits, because sometimes they stay the same, and then sometimes they actually go up, you know, $500 to $1,000. So for tax year 2013, investors can actually contribute up to $5,500 as an individual, and I just, you know, talked about that with the Roth. So many individuals still don't take advantage of the extra $1,000 catch-up provision. So if you're over 50, you can make a bigger contribution to the IRA, and a lot of times people aren't aware of this, what they call catch-up provision, that's available to you if you're over 50. So, you know, for instance, if you have a married couple, both over 50, you can contribute, you know, a lot more money into your IRA. So if you have $6,500 apiece, you know, you can, in essence, you know, put in $13,000 into your IRAs for 2013. So really taking advantage of putting in as much as you can on the in the IRAs. And also, you know, those catch-up contributions are a really great opportunity to jumpstart your retirement saving program, really having an opportunity to make a bigger or more sizable contribution to your IRA. So another IRA savings tip that I would say is really make your IRA contributions early each year, potentially maximizing the tax-deferred growth of assets over the life of the IRA. So try to make it as early as possible. I know sometimes that's kind of hard. You may just be at the tax your tax advisor and say, oh, you can put money in, and then you'll decide to put money in. But probably try to, you know, make your contributions early or systematically save into an IRA throughout the year.
Uh-huh.
You might also, you know, I know this is counterintuitive, but a lot of times people might want to make what we call a non-deductible contribution. That is, potentially have more available to convert to a IRA should you decide to do so. Make sure you consult a CPA. But if you're not eligible to contribute to a Roth, there's no income limits for a person to convert to a Roth. So if you're in that situation where you can't make a contribution into the Roth and your IRA is not tax deductible any longer and you're not getting any real benefit, you may want to make what they call a non-deductible contribution and then convert it to Roth later. So you can do it, you know, a little bit different, in order to take advantage of that tax-free bucket that I talked about a little bit earlier, because you're over the limit, but there's no income limit to do a conversion. But you do have to pay the present taxes on that conversion. And then so, you know, there's not that income limit, but like I said, you do have to make sure that you have some type of side account or something that will be able to pay the taxes if you decide to do a conversion, because it is taxable. But what you're doing is taking advantage of low tax rates now versus something that may be more taxed in the future. So you have to do the trade-off. It's kind of like what we talked about with the Roth. Do you want kind of the tax now, or do you want the tax later? If we take advantage of doing a conversion to reposition it to a tax-free bucket now, that may be a better situation for you.
Okay. Excellent. Now, we've discussed spouses a little bit. You've talked about how each spouse can contribute into their own IRA. But there could also be situations where one spouse works and the other one doesn't work for many different reasons. So talk about the whole package of spousal contributions. I'm sure that there's a lot of information that we should discuss there in terms of what's smart to do and what might be a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, really one of the mistakes is really assuming that a non-working spouse cannot contribute to an IRA. A lot of times people figure there's an income requirement, and so the spouse, if he or she is just working, not working or working in the household, that they can't contribute. So the way it works is that, you know, most of the time you would need earned income to make an IRA contribution, you know, which, like what we said before, really makes it seems like it's impossible for a non-working spouse to do that. But what happens is the non-working spouse can actually fund an IRA up to the same limit as the working spouse by using the working spouse's earned income in order to qualify. So what you're looking at is really if a husband or wife and they're not working, looking at that working spouse earned income, and then also being able to contribute to, you know, the maximum up to $5,500 for 2013 into an IRA, and what they call a spousal IRA. So you can actually do that as a contribution. So the husband or wife can make a contribution, and the non-working spouse can also do a contribution based on the working spouse's earned income in order to qualify for that. So really taking advantage of that particular situation. A lot of people may not be aware because, you know, they assume that I'm not working, I can't make a contribution, so you're not really taking advantage of that particular one. And I see that mistake a lot of times, and I really have to introduce it to people as a possibility because this is one of those things that's not intuitive if you don't do some research on making a contribution as a spousal IRA. And so that's basically how that one works.
Mm-hmm. I'm probably ranging off the topic here and dreaming up things that occur to me, but let me ask this, and
yes.
It's not the time to talk about it, you can tell me.
In the case of
a non-working spouse, what if there was a situation where the non-working spouse received an inheritance? Would a receipt of an inheritance, would that be something where you would advise them to consider putting some or all of the inheritance into an IRA, or would you probably consult with them and say there would be a better place for an inheritance to be invested?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking that was probably because you're looking at, you know, the inheritance. You have to have, the way the IRS rules work, there has to be earned income. So your inheritance is not earned income.
Okay.
So that may or may not qualify for an IRA contribution with that particular situation. So you're looking at other type of investments outside of an IRA situation.
Mm-hmm.
So that would probably be the answer to that particular question because everything is based on earned income, and your inheritance is basically, you know, inheritance or gift and things like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's other ways to invest that in something different besides an IRA.
Sure. I'm sure that other ways that would make a lot more sense, but somehow it just jumped in my head. So I thought, well, I might as well ask you.
Yeah, you might as well ask it. There's no hold barred. Ask anything you want.
All right. Well, as long as we're talking about inheritances, to me that leads me to thinking about trusts. Quite often, you hear your parents or something have set up some kind of a trust, and so let's talk about the concepts of having a trust, and the trust owns the IRA instead of an individual owning the IRA, and other ways that you think that trusts and IRAs integrate together in ways that we need to know about.
Okay. Well, the first thing, the mistake, the IRA mistake there is really placing the title of an IRA into a trust and not having the trust as a beneficiary. So the difference being transferring ownership of an IRA to a trust basically causes that particular asset at that particular time to become immediately taxable because what happens including the 10% penalty if the owner is younger than age 59, because it doesn't have the same rules and regulations as a person. A trust is not a person.
Right.
You know, that's the whole thing about IRAs. It's called individual retirement account. And so the trust is not a person, so the IRA becomes immediately taxable, including the 10% if you're younger than 59 and a half. So that's mistake number one. So you may want to consider naming the trust as a beneficiary. However, there are also reasons not to name a trust as a beneficiary because it could limit some of the payouts available to the trust beneficiary. So the way that works is that the potential disadvantage in naming a trust as a beneficiary, for one thing, you will be funding the trust with pre-tax money. So let's say you put, for example, $500,000 of IRA money into a trust. The trust will not actually be funded with that $500,000. It will be funded with the $500,000 minus the taxes owed on the IRA when the money is distributed to the trust.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the thing you have to be concerned about. And by contrast, let's say, you know, if you had the $500,000 of cash, you put that cash into the trust, then the trust is funded with the full $500,000 because the cash is after-tax money. So that IRA hasn't been taxed yet. It's a pre-tax money. So basically, once it goes into the trust, it's the money minus the distribution in order to get it into the trust. So that's a disadvantage of naming a trust as a beneficiary for an IRA. Also, if you're married, there's another risk in naming the trust as a beneficiary, is that the spouse at that point cannot automatically roll over the IRA into an IRA in his or her own name when they die, when you die.
Uh-huh.
So we had talked a little bit about, you know, taking a spousal rollover, non-spousal rollovers last time we had spoke.
Right.
But if you do the trust as a beneficiary, that basically counts your spouse out on automatically rolling over into his or her own IRA in their name. And also for a spouse to be able to do that, the spouse, you know, must not be a trust. So you have being able to roll it all over as a deceased spouse's IRA is really a huge advantage if one should think twice about giving that particular right up.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you don't want to count your spouse out by
right.
naming the trust as a beneficiary, because then that gives your spouse no recourse in order to roll over the IRA in his or her own name, and then also, you know, taking advantage of some of the other you know, stretch options and things we talked about in the last phone call. So by doing that, you're really kind of superseding some of the rules that are available to your spouse by doing that. So that's, you know, one of the things is really transferring ownership to an IRA, you know, just going to become immediately taxable, and then naming a beneficiary. There's also some caveats that you want to be concerned about as well, namely monies that are pre-tax versus after-tax, and then also giving the spouse not having the spouse having control of the IRA if they wanted to do something different with it. But always make sure you consult your estate planning professional who's knowledgeable in how IRAs work before deciding to name a trust as an IRA beneficiary. You can do it, but, you know, make sure you do some consultation and some research on your own before you make a decision on that, because there are certain rules and regulations on trust and IRAs, and you do have to get a professional that's very knowledgeable in that area to advise you on the best way to do that.
Mm-hmm. Would there be any benefit to naming a trust as a beneficiary as opposed to naming a spouse? It doesn't seem like, from what you're saying to me, that there would be any benefit.
I mean, it really just kind of depends. There's other ways to do it. I mean, you could fund the same thing with, you know, maybe a bypass trust or something different, and in order to name the trust as a beneficiary. There's reasons to do it, but and there's a way to kind of get around that whole spousal thing as well. You really have to have a good estate planning attorney in order to do that.
Okay.
So, you know, those are really some things that you want to consider when you're doing it. I'm not saying it's you know, it's right or wrong. You can definitely do the name the trust as a beneficiary. Just know the rules and regulations and the limitations that it gives you with some of the payout options that are available to you if you decide to do a trust as a beneficiary.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you've discussed, you've brought up the word penalties while we were answering some of these earlier questions that we've had. So I know that one of your big goals is helping the people that you're working with to make sure that they avoid penalties whenever possible. So are there any other situations where there might be unnecessary penalties, penalties that we could avoid if we were aware of the trap and make sure that we stay away from that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it always seems like when IRAs, you're always dealing with some type of penalties if you do the wrong thing. So unnecessary penalties, and I'm going to go over a few of them because there's about three different ones to make sure you avoid. So one of the IRA mistakes is really paying unnecessary penalties on early, what we call pre-59 and a half IRA distributions, because a lot of people say paying the 10% in taxes is definitely an unpleasant situation. So I always advise people, if at all possible, try not to take the distribution before 59 and a half because you do have that 10% penalty.
Mm-hmm.
But what most people are unaware of is there is an IRS code called Section 72T, which allows individuals who are not yet 59 and a half years old to take what we call SEPP distributions. They're called Series of Substantial Equal Periodic Payments, SEPP, from an IRA without incurring the penalties. But you do have to have you do have to still pay the income tax, but you don't have the penalty.
Mm-hmm.
So under Section 72T, withdrawals can be made from an IRA for 5 years or until 59 and a half, whichever is later. Distributions are basically calculated on one of three methods. What they do is look at the life expectancy, so the life expectancy of the owner of the IRA, which is generally a smaller distribution out of the IRA. They annuitize it, so it's more than annuitization, and then or an amortization, which is generally a larger result. So what you're doing is basically saying, I need money, 55 or so. You could do, if you knew you needed money out of your IRA, but you didn't want to have the 10% penalty, you would sign up for a Section 72T distribution, an SEPP, and take money from your IRA systematically over 5 years. Now, as long as your withdrawal is made based on those requirements, you won't have those penalties. But what happens is that you do have to take these equal, what they call systematic, substantial equal payments. So you just can't do it here or there or willy-nilly or whatever because the IRS is saying you're not taking advantage of 72T the way it's supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
So you sign up for either one of those, the 72T, one of the methods of distribution, and then basically for those 5 years until you get up to 59 and a half, then that's the payment that you would get. Okay, so be careful also because failure to follow the rules can cause a retroactive 10% penalty on all the distributions. So like I said, if you do willy-nilly or if you stop it and start it later or whatever, you know, you're not adhering to the Section 72 rules per IRS, and they're going to say, you know, we kind of gave you this particular SEPP distribution. You're not still playing by the rules. Now you have the 10% penalty on all the distributions out. So you don't want to fall into that.
Uh-huh.
So really be careful if you're not going to do it properly.
Okay.
But that's the way to avoid the 10% taxes pre-59 and a half if you do a Section 72T distribution out of it.
All right.
I know that was a mouthful.
Well, important topic, though.
Yeah.
I've heard of SEPP, but I just didn't know that much about it, so I appreciate. And I'm sure all of our listeners do, too, getting to know a little bit more about what that's all about. Are there any other unnecessary penalties or penalties that we need to avoid tripping over?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about the required minimum distribution penalties, making sure you don't fall into that. That's a big one as well. The pre-59.5 is always an issue, and we just addressed that with the early distribution penalty with the FDPP situation. But those are generally most of the penalties that people fall into when they're dealing with IRAs. Either they don't take enough money out of the IRA, and then they get hit with the 50% penalty for an R&D, or they can't wait to get at the money, and they need it before 59.5, and then they fall into paying early withdrawal penalties as well. So really trying to get past a lot of those issues, which would be what we just talked about, FDPP, and then also another end of it with the 70.5 part, making sure that you take the proper distribution and have it calculated properly from you. So always look at the balance of all of the IRAs as a unit, not individually, because that's the way that it's calculated based on the account balance of all of the IRAs and then taking a distribution from that. So you really have to make sure you don't have things all in different spots and you forget about one of them. You didn't take out enough and you don't want to get hit with that penalty. So I would probably say the early withdrawal penalty, and then on the other end of the spectrum, the R&D calculation. I mean, R&D distribution is the other penalty that people tend to fall into when they're dealing with their IRAs.
All right. Excellent information. I'm not sure that I've got any more questions for you, so what I'm thinking is that I'm going to open the call up so that all of our guests who are listening can ask a question and can just speak out if you've got a question. And Pam will handle whatever you throw at her, I'm sure of that. So the call is unmuted now. Please speak up if you've got a question.
No questions, huh?
I guess not. I've got a few that it came in through the web. So why don't I ask a few of those, and we'll see if that gets anybody else having a willingness to ask us their questions. We've been hearing that there's some potential that the age for Social Security will be made older than it is right now. And I know that next month in April, on our call on the 4th of April, we'll be talking about Social Security, and you'll probably talk about that at that time. But this question says, just the way that we're talking about the potential to make the time when we can receive benefits from Social Security become a higher age, do you expect that there could be a chance that 70.5 age that you keep mentioning with the IRA, do you see that there could be a chance that could become an older age?
I don't think they're, in my opinion, I don't think they're in conjunction with each other, because, you know, the IRAs have typically had the same rules and regulations since they've been instituted. The Social Security, you know, based on, you know, when you could take out the earliest 62 full retirement age, somewhere between 66 and 67, and then basically 70 being the highest point that you can take that out, they may skew those numbers a little bit in terms of your full retirement age being maybe now 70 and then maybe waiting a little bit longer to take a distribution out for that. But between full retirement age and Social Security, you're actually, you know, gaining a little bit more money. And I just looked at, then we'll talk a little bit about that as well on the phone call, is that for each year you don't take it past the time that you could have taken it, it actually gains 8% per year. So the longer you can actually wait to take a Social Security, your star is drawn with Social Security, you may get a higher benefit based on waiting a longer period of time anyway. Mm-hmm. So I would probably take a look at that. But in terms of the IRA and the Social Security being different numbers, as far as I know, most of it is the IRA rules are still, you know, the 59.5 early withdrawal, 70.5 distribution, and I haven't seen any particular talk on anything changing in that, in those instances, in terms of those regulations.
Okay, excellent. Well, here's a question that's come in through the web, and that is, how hard is it to change the beneficiary of an IRA once the IRA is set up?
If you're still living, I mean, you can change the beneficiary, you know, as often as you would like, and based on, you know, just kind of contacting your institution who holds your IRA, you know, from there. So you can always make changes on it. So it's just really a matter of filling out the form and then, you know, making the changes from there. But making sure you keep up with looking at it each year, if you do need to make changes, making sure it's the right person on the account. What I run into a lot of times is that younger people tend to, you know, either open up IRA younger, then they put their parents on. Next thing you know, they get married, they have kids, and their parents are still on the IRA
right.
as their beneficiary. So making sure you look at it periodically will remind you, oh, I need to do that. And what I've seen a lot as well is people don't take their ex-spouses off of their either 401k or IRA, maybe a little bit more of the IRAs, but their employer, you know, for the 401k plans, you know, they've gotten divorced, they forgot to visit HR to change their beneficiary, and the next thing you know, ex-spouse is still a beneficiary on your IRAs and the 401k.
That causes a bit of discord.
You probably don't want that to happen.
Right.
So really periodically checking, and then if you do want to make changes, they're fairly simple. Just contact your institution that holds your IRA and say, I want to make a beneficiary change. They'll send you the forms, and you can, you know, update those as well. Now, if it is someone besides your spouse, then you do have to have your spouse sign off on that. Well, most institutions will say, if you change it from your spouse to somebody else, then you do have to have them sign off on it to make sure they are aware that they're no longer the beneficiary on your IRA, and you know, now it's your kids or, you know, someone else that you wanted to take over.
Okay.
But it's fairly simple to do.
All right. Next question. Could you talk a bit about when it makes sense to split your contribution between a Roth and a traditional IRA?
That probably depends on, you know, if you want tax benefits now versus the future. We had talked a little bit about kind of having the dessert now or having dessert later. If you're probably in a situation where you think that you're going to out income, so to speak, a Roth, you may want to start putting more money there to take advantage of the Roth as long as you can before you price yourself out, so to speak, or make more money and you can't contribute any more to that. If you still want the tax benefits from an IRA now, then you may want to also split a little bit as well, but I would probably suggest putting as much money into the Roth when you're eligible to put money into the Roth now versus later, unless you absolutely need the tax benefit now in the present time and to take off your taxes.
All right. Okay. Well, I've just kind of hogged you with the questions here, so I'm going to give another chance for our listening audience here to speak up and ask any questions that they've got. Don't be afraid. Pam doesn't bite.
I don't bite hard.
Well, all right. I see people on the call. They just aren't wanting to talk to us, Pam. So I've got a couple more here. Could you talk a bit about the estate tax consequences of a surviving spouse inheriting an IRA?
The estate tax consequences, okay, so you have a spouse who inherits the IRA?
Right.
Okay. Basically, you know, once your spouse inherits the IRA, it becomes, you know, either theirs, if they want to take ownership of it themselves, or if they want to, in essence, kind of stretch it out in terms of what they call a beneficiary IRA. So there's no estate taxes related to it in that part because they have actually inherited it. And what they do is take distributions from it either as a beneficiary through an RMD calculation that we talked about before, or if they take ownership of it of themselves, and then basically the timeline is their particular life expectancy, and then they would just take distributions out as they would with their own IRA distribution. So if it's a spousal rollover, then you don't have to deal with any estate taxes as it relates to your IRA. And it basically becomes a beneficiary IRA for your spouse, and or if they decided to take ownership of it for themselves, make it their own IRA. But they don't have any estate tax issues to deal with in that instance. Mm-hmm. Just regular RMD calculation distributions that they got to pay tax on those.
All right. Well, once they receive the beneficiary inheritance, do they usually then merge that in with their own IRA if they have one, or does it make more sense to keep them separate?
Well, what you're looking at there is that probably, you know, it depends on the age of the spouse, because if you take it over as a beneficiary IRA, as a spousal rollover, then you're basically using the life expectancy of your spouse who had passed away. So that may be a longer period of time and a shorter period versus kind of merging them together, and then, you know, you're dealing with your own life expectancy. So it really just kind of depends on, you know, what's the best way to do it. You can definitely have your own IRA, but then you can have an IRA, what they call a beneficiary IRA. So it would be, you know, beneficiary IRA for the benefit of, and then your particular name, and then the deceased spouse. So it would be titled a little bit differently. You would have ownership of it, but the way it's titled, it's called a beneficiary IRA, and then it follows the same rules as a beneficiary IRA with the longevity and the life expectancy of that particular person versus if you had took ownership on your own. So you really did have to, you know, consult your own professionals to take a look at it to see what's in your best interest. You know, should I merge it together? Should I take advantage of this? But usually if it's a longer, if your spouse is older, you know, you may want to do something a little bit different because then you're working on the numbers that they have versus yours. You know, mm-hmm. So if you're younger, it'll give you a little bit more time, so you don't have to take out bigger chunks. So it really just kind of depends on your particular situation, but make sure you consult your financial professional before you make that decision to take it over or not.
Okay. And going along with that, we might as well talk about the kind of the flip side of that. What are the tax consequences if the beneficiary is not a surviving spouse? Because you mentioned earlier that you might have turned it over to your kids, or you might have turned it over to your grandchildren. I assume it would be, not that you turned mm-hmm. it over to a church or something like that, but I suppose it could be an entity mm-hmm. like that too. So what would be the tax consequences in the case where the beneficiary is not the spouse?
Yeah, well, it's what we call a non-spousal inherited IRA. So basically the way that works, and we talked a little bit about it last time, was if you decide to, let's say if it was multiple beneficiaries, one could disclaim it, one can do take it on. You basically take the life expectancy of the oldest beneficiary. So, you know, there's no estate tax dealing with it. It just basically becomes an inherited IRA for that particular person, and then they need to start taking distributions out of it. Let me step back on the spousal. The spousal account, if they decided to take it on, they could defer those RMDs until the time at which that person, your spouse, would have turned, let's say, 70 and a half, so you can defer those RMDs. What happens with a non-spousal rollover, they inherit it, and then they need to start that RMD schedule right away on those particular accounts that they inherit. So if you're not a spouse and you inherit an IRA, make sure you definitely consult your tax advisor and your financial planner and say, I inherited this thing. Now how do I get it, you know, how do I get it set up? Because you at that point, you're not working with the 70-and-a-half rule with RMDs. You're working with every year that you have inherited it, taking a distribution out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have that choice, as would a spouse, to defer those RMDs to a later age. That a non-spousal beneficiary needs to start taking those RMD calculations the same as if they were 70-and-a-half. to start taking the money out, but it is, you know, during, on that tax year. So the year you inherited it, the next year you need to start making distributions out of it.
Okay.
So it doesn't give you a whole lot of choice as a non-spousal beneficiary.
All right. Good to keep in mind. Okay, well, we're getting close to the end of our hour, so I'm going to make one more plea to those of you who are listening to the call. If you've got any questions, don't hesitate. The lines are open. Just speak up and ask Pam a question. Yes? I think I hear someone. Okay, I don't.
Maybe? Okay. I thought I heard something too, but they didn't speak up.
Right. All right. Well, as usual, it's been great talking to you today, Pam, and I want to say again, remind people that our next call will be next month on the 4th. And
yep.
We will be talking about Social Security. I will be putting information out in my usual NABBW communications information as to the topics that we'll be covering on that call. But for those of you who are listening, start thinking now about what kind of things you'd like to know about Social Security, and then be sure and when I announce the information for the call, be sure and get your question into the Q&A box so that we can make sure that we answer your question. And that said, Pam, I want to thank you again for being our guest and for the great discussion on these 6 additional IRA planning mistakes that so many people make. And I, of course, will give you a chance to tell me, is there anything else that you'd like to say before we wrap up this call?
Well, I mean, I just really want to stress to people that, you know, common mistakes, you know, keep the common mistakes in mind when you are on your road to retirement, because it's all about a retirement road, and there's a lot of wrong turns you can take, as we can see with these 12 mistakes. And like I said, they're not really intuitive. So if you don't work with a professional, if you don't consult your tax advisor, these are a lot of mistakes that most people would make if they are not aware of it. So I hope people jotted down everything that we talked about. We'll revisit the phone call afterward, because it was a lot of complicated estate planning and tax issues that are related to that. So really make sure you listen to the phone call again as well. And as usual, you know, my email address is listed as Pamela@JacksonSams.com. If you have any additional questions after the phone call that you want to clarify, I will be happy to fill those additional questions as well.
Excellent. I was going to make sure we gave your email address, so I'm glad you did, and I'll say it again in case someone didn't have a pen ready just when you said it. If you have any questions after the call, Pam is happy to answer them. She's not hard to find. Just email her at Pamela@JacksonSams.com, and as she just said, she will answer your questions, and we will make sure that everybody else knows about those too, if you're willing to share the question that you have. Now, let's see. Anything else that I should say? I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. It was another great call here, Pam, and I thank you for your effort and time on that. And next month, April 4th, at the same time, as I said, Pam will be talking about Social Security issues, a big topic of interest to all of us boomers as we reach the age where we begin to qualify, and especially because in the political arena, they're talking about messing around with when Social Security is something that people qualify for. So it's a hot topic right now, and I'm excited that we're going to be talking about it in April. So everyone listening to the call, be sure and look for an announcement of our next call with Pam Sams in April on the 4th at the same time, which is 8 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Central, and et cetera. So thank you, Pam, and good night to everyone.
Okay, thank you. Good night.
Good night. Bye.